Everyone have one of these? Okay, should be on page 4 of the outline. Now, the Olivet Discourse, or what he said about the last days, was introduced at the end of Matthew chapter 23, after his renunciation of Israel's leadership for leading the nation to reject him as the Messiah. And then as he walked out of the temple, the disciples pointed out to him the magnificent stones that made up the buildings of the temple compound, which was largely reconstructed by Herod the Great. And he made a statement that the time is coming, there'll be not one stone on top of another that will not be thrown down. And then they left the Jerusalem and crossed the Kidron Valley and went up to the top of the Mount of Olives, is when they asked him three questions, and the purpose of the Olivet Discourse is to respond to those three questions. And because not every gospel writer records everything he did, everything he said in any incident, in order to get the full picture, it's good to work through a harmony of the gospels. So these pages are copies of pages from the Aureal Harmony. And then, in the parallel passages, we can see some of the additional information given by one writer over another. And they asked him three questions. Now, at this point, we should remember they do not yet know the program of two comings. They do not yet know or understand the program of death and resurrection. So three questions are based upon the rabbinic eschatology, that there'll be a period of trials and tribulations, and the Messiah will come and set up the Messianic kingdom. When he answers those three questions, he will answer them from the way things will actually happen. But when they're asking the questions, it's based upon not knowing about the two comings of the Messiah, not knowing about the program of death and resurrection. And the first question they asked was, what will be the sign that these things are about to come to pass? And these things in that context refers back to his prophecy about the coming destruction of the city and the temple. So what is the sign that these things are about to come to pass? As we come to the section on the sign of the fall of Jerusalem, that's when he answers the first question recorded only by Luke, whereas Mark and Matthew deal primarily with his answers about the second and third question. Luke answers the first question. And in verse 20 of our passage, when you see Jerusalem compassed with armies, then know that her desolation is at hand. And the sign the city is about to be destroyed is when you see the city surrounded by armies. The Jewish revolt against Rome broke out in the year AD 66. And the then Roman governor, named Cestus Gallus, G-A-L-L-U-S, thought this was just a local revival around Jerusalem. He brought up his legions and besieged the city of Jerusalem. And for the Messianic community living in the city at that point of time, they took that to be the sign that Yeshua, that Jesus promised to give them. And they knew they could not pick up weapons to defend the city, but they were to abandon it. With the Romans surrounding the city, they could not do so. What happened, what Gallus began to realize, this was not merely a local revolt, it was a nationwide revolt, and Jewish forces were cutting his supply lines. He was forced to lift the siege and head back for Caesarea. And while Jerusalem was the Jewish capital of the land, Caesarea was the Roman capital of the land. So for a two-year period, from 66 to 68, Jerusalem was no longer under siege, and so the Messianic community followed the admonition here. And that's in verse 21, then let them that are in Judah flee unto the mountains, let him that is in the midst of her depart out, let not them that are therein, in the midst of her, not let those from outside enter therein, nor should they stay inside. And so now they took the opportunity with the Roman besiegers away from the city, that they would leave the city at this point, and the whole Messianic community in Jerusalem, joined by Messianic Jews from Galilee, from Judea, even from what is now called the Golan Heights, and they went to the city of Pella, spelled P-E-L-L-A, on the east side of the river, and that was outside the war zone. And that's where they escaped to. And after the war, they would go back. But at this point, this, they would follow the order, and they spend the war years on the east side of the city. And what he prophesied would indeed happen. And he points out in verse 22, "For these are days of vengeance, that all things which are written may be fulfilled. Woe to them that are a child, and them that give suck in those days, for there shall be great distress upon the land, and wrath upon this people. And they shall fall by the edge of the sword, and shall be led captive to all the nations, and Jerusalem shall be trodden down of the Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles be fulfilled." So he points out the difficulty of trying to escape if for women in advanced stages of pregnancy and other issues, but the Messianic community was able to escape. And according to certain sources, while a total of 1,200,000 Jewish people were killed in that first Roman war, none of the Messianic Jewish community suffered the consequences for obeying the Lord and escaping the war zone. And now they will be eventually trotted down and so on until the times of the Gentiles be fulfilled. The times of the Gentiles is the theme of the book of Daniel, where Daniel points out there will be four Gentile empires that will dominate the Jewish people and the Jewish city for century after century. And what that means is that from the time that the last Davidic king was removed from the Davidic throne, which was Zedekiah by Babylon, and there's not been a Davidic king sitting upon the Davidic throne since then, they'll be ruled by Gentile powers. So the time of the Gentiles began in 586 BC with the destruction of the city and the first temple, and continues to this day and will continue until once again a Davidic king will be sitting upon the Davidic throne and ruling from the city of Jerusalem. And that is the essential goal. This does not mean there would not be temporary Jewish control in between, and there were four periods of time when Jews regained control of the city but then lost it. The first time was during the Maccabean period from about 160 BC until about roughly about in the 90s BC when it was taken over by Rome. It was independent, but then it fell to the Romans. The second time they were freed of any Roman conquest or Gentile conquest was during the first Jewish revolt from the year AD 66 to AD 70, but then it was lost again. The third time this happened is in the second Jewish revolt from AD 132 to 135, called the Bar Kokhba Revolt, but then they lost it again. In 1967, with the Six-Day War, they gained it again, and they remain in authority over the city until the midpoint of the tribulation. As we shall see a bit later in this hour, when at that point, the mid-tribulation, it will fall again, and the Jews will again have to be exiled from the land, not worldwide, but mostly in the areas of the Middle East. But times of the Gentiles did not end in 967, which was a popular teaching, because you did not yet have a Davidic king upon the Davidic throne. But once that happens again with the second coming of the Messiah, then that will bring the times of the Gentiles to an end. And so in this manner, he answered the first question. What would be the sign that the city and the temple are about to be destroyed? And the answer is, when you see the city surrounded by armies, then know that her desolation is at hand. Moving on now to the next segment of that page, we come now to the Great Tribulation, an event that will last for 7 years. They'll be triggered by a specific event not recorded here in the Olivet Discourse, but rather recorded in Daniel chapter 9, verse 27, Daniel 9:27, also Isaiah chapter 28, verses 14 through 22, Isaiah 28, verses 14 through 22. There'll be the signing of a seven-year covenant between Israel and the Antichrist. And that covenant will actually trigger the 7 years of tribulation. And until that event happens, the tribulation has not yet begun. And this first subdivision deals with the first half of the tribulation, which lasts for 3.5 years. He mentions basically 5 key events that will happen the first half of the tribulation. First of all, by the way, this section is very similar to what Luke wrote earlier, but there's a crucial timing difference. As we saw last night, he introduces that section of his gospel with the phrase, "But before all these things," because he provided the sign of when the last days begin, which is when nation against nation and kingdom against kingdom, which was a symbol or a phrase symbolic of a world war. And so the contrast early in Matthew 24 is when you see local wars here and there, that's not a sign of the last days. When you see a world war, that's the sign that the last days have begun. And so as we mentioned, the last days began with the First and Second World War. And the way we have to determine where we are in prophecy is not how world events affect the USA or Washington, D.C., which is often the criteria in most sensational type prophecy books, but how events of the world affect Jewish history. And the Zionist movement began in the late 1800s, but the impetus for its massive growth were a result of the First World War. And the events of the Second World War and the Holocaust led to the reestablishment of Israel, the Jewish state. And so we have to deal with how events deal with specifically with Jewish history. And so in Luke's account, when he mentioned the things he's about to describe happens before what he just said, but in Matthew, notice in verse 9, then he, in the previous context, he mentioned the sign of the last days, nation against nation, kingdom against kingdom. But then he begins to deal with the events of the tribulation, and so it's a different time element than what Luke gave us. And with this section, he mentions 5 things. First of all, it'll be a time of tremendous persecution, the persecution of believers and others. Secondly, it'll also be the rise of many false prophets claiming to speak in God's name but receive no prophecy from him. Thirdly, it'll be a time when there'll be the increase of iniquity, where iniquity increases more and more. And a key element he doesn't point out, but Paul points out in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verse 6 and 7, 2 Thess 2, verse 6 and 7, that then the restrainment of lawlessness will finally cease, and then lawlessness will take over. Fourthly, he points out that Jewish people who live during this period and survive to the end are the ones that will be saved. A reference back to Zechariah chapter 13, verse 8 and 9, Zechariah 13, verse 8 and 9, where Zechariah points out that in the persecutions of the Jewish people, in the tribulation, 2/3 will end up dying. Under Hitler and Nazi Germany, 1/3 of the Jewish population died, but here 2/3 will die, but 1/3 will survive, and the whole 1/3 that survives will all come to believe. And that will trigger the events of the second coming, something we'll come back to a bit later. And so those Jews who survive to the end are the ones that will be undergo a national salvation. But fifthly, he points out there'll be the preaching of the gospel of the kingdom throughout the whole world before the end comes. The word gospel simply means good news. It reflects a specific Hebrew word, but it means good news. And the good news here is more specifically the good news of the kingdom. What kingdom? The Messianic kingdom. And so the good news about the kingdom and what will precede the establishment of the kingdom will be proclaimed throughout the world for a testimony into all the nations. He does not say how this will be accomplished, but the answer lies in Revelation chapter 7, verses 1 through 8. Revelation 7, verses 1 through 8, where using 144,000 Jewish males, single males, that will be the ones that will be living in different parts of the world, that will be brought to faith, and they will be the ones to proclaim the gospel to all the world. And later in the same chapter, verses 9 through 17, the results is that Gentile believers will be found among all nations, all tribes, and all different ethnic groups. And so these are the events of the first half of the tribulation. It's a period of time when the Jews do suffer, but no more or no less than the Gentiles would suffer. We get to the second half, then it's a whole different picture, because now the focus will be specifically upon the Jewish people. And there'll be a special Nazi-like program in the second half of the tribulation that will try to annihilate all the Jewish people for reasons we'll mention in a few more minutes. So let me point out some of the specific events of the second half, and it begins with one specific event in Matthew's account, verse 15. You should be on the next page now. When therefore you see the abomination of desolation spoken of through Daniel the prophet, and what Daniel spoke about it is in Daniel chapter 9, verse 27, Daniel 9, 27, and chapter 12, verse 11. Chapter 12, verse 11. And what the abomination is that the Antichrist will show his attitude towards the Jewish people by breaking the seven-year covenant. And then with that breaking of the covenant, he'll take over the Jewish temple. He'll commit the abomination of desolation in two stages. First of all, he will sit in the holy place and declare himself to be God Almighty and call upon the whole world to worship him as God and to signify their acceptance of his deity by taking his mark of 666. That option will be given only to Gentiles because Jewish people will be targeted for destruction. But the Gentiles will have the option to believe on him as God and take his mark or not take it. And those who do not take it will be the ones that will be marked out for extermination. Now, he doesn't stay in Jerusalem, as we know from other passages like Revelation 17, 18, among other passages like Isaiah chapters 13 and 14, also chapter 50 and 51 of Revelation. 50 and 51 of the book of Jeremiah. He will set up his world headquarters in the city of Babylon, which will largely be rebuilt by then. And that will be his economic capital and his political capital, but the religious capital will still be in Jerusalem because of the image that will be made of him and set up, and the image becomes alive. So it is that event that is the abomination of desolation. And that abomination will begin the second half of the tribulation. It's also a sign for the Jewish people to recognize what is going to happen. And at that point, there's going to be a flight from the land. So in the second part of Matthew 24 here, specifically in verse 15 and 16, verse 16 says, "Then let them that are in Judea flee unto the mountains. Let him on the housetop not go out and to take out the things that are in his house. Let him that is in the field not return back to take his cloak." The whole focus is that Israel will now have to flee the land. Again, there will not be a worldwide dispersion, but there will be mostly a scattering within the areas of the Middle East more specifically. And the emphasis is on the urgency, without a second to lose. If you happen to be on the housetop for any reason, do not take the time to go off the roof and go inside the house to take any possession, but from where you are getting down to the ground, make your way out of the country. Or if you're out plowing in the field and you hear of this event taking place, don't take the time to go back to living quarters to take so much as a coat. But from the place where you're plowing, leave the country. And the urgency is on the need for speed and for haste, without a single second to lose. He then points out three major difficulties that will make it very difficult for a quick escape. So verse 19, "But woe unto them that are with child and that give suck in those days." And the first element is women in advances of pregnancy will have a more difficult time to be able to escape with the speed that is necessary. And the second issue is if it happens to be in the months of winter. And Thirdly, on a Sabbath day. What's the problem of winter? It seldom snows in Israel. What would be the problem of winter? There's some key difference between Israel and the USA. For example, we build highways here, and when we come to any kind of a water gully, the American way is to build a bridge over the water gully, whether it's dry or flowing. Not so in Israel, but much of the highways were built, were plowed into the water gullies and out again. These are called wadis. A wadi is dry all summer. It's dry most of winter, but when the rains begin to fall in the winter months, water begins rushing down these wadis, sometimes with tremendous speed, often destroying these highways. In the 3 years I lived in Israel, more than one time driving around Israel, I would have to make a major detour because the wadi had been destroyed that way. And if they tried to flee by means of these wadis, then a much more dangerous issue. How dangerous it could be was made vivid when I was a student at the Hebrew University in the winter of 1966-1967. 40 French tourists were heading down a wadi towards an archaeological site. It was not raining where they happened to be walking, but it began raining elsewhere, and suddenly water began rushing down. And within only 30 minutes, 38 of the 40 French tourists drowned, only two survived. So pray that your flight be not in winter. And finally, the third difficulty, if it happens to happen to fall on the Sabbath day. In Israel, the Sabbath is from sundown Friday until sundown Saturday. At that point, public transportation closes down. There's no buses running. There's no trains running. You would have to depend on your own automobile to try to find a way of escaping. And all of this will again be create a difficulty. See, it points out three problem issues of being able to escape quickly and as fast as possible. Because in verse 21, for then shall be great tribulation, such as had not been from the beginning of the world until now, no, nor ever shall be. And except those days have been shortened, no flesh would have been saved. But for the elect's sake, those days shall be shortened. He points out, as much as the Jewish people have suffered, and the worst situation for us was the Holocaust. I lost 17 members of my own family in the Holocaust. And such a situation will be tremendously increased during the second half of the tribulation. Because again, Satan will inaugurate a worldwide program with a Nazi-style program for total Jewish annihilation. And the reason lies in what we mentioned at the end of Matthew 23, that he understands the precondition to the second coming. The rapture for the body of the Messiah has no preconditions. It can happen any moment of time, but the actual second coming is part of God's program with Israel. And the precondition is Israel's national salvation. And what Israel must do for the Messiah to return is two things. Number one, confess the national sin of rejecting him on the grounds of being demonized. And also, secondly, for leading the nation to reject him as well. So until these two things occur, there'll be no second coming. And Satan knows this. And Satan knows that once the second coming does occur, his career will be safe. But he also knows that there'll be no second coming until there is a national salvation of Israel, and those was pleading for the Messiah to return. And so that is what is stimulating this massive persecution of the Jewish people. And in verse 22, talks about that days had been, if he doesn't shorten the days, the Jews would not survive. That doesn't mean that the second half will be less than 1,260 days. The prophecies in both Daniel and Revelation emphasize that both halves are exactly 1,260 days. The force of the Greek term simply means to be cut short. The period of persecution will be exactly 1,260 days and will not be allowed to continue 1 second beyond that period of time. If it continues any longer, then no part of the Jewish population will survive. Then he goes on to point out, going beyond worldwide anti-Semitism and also Israel promise of Israel's survival. He also points out, beginning in verse 23, the rise of false messiahs. And if somebody tells you the Messiah has come, he's here, or the Messiah is there, they don't believe him. Because unlike the first coming that came in a small situation, a small place, and a very quiet place, and very few people knew about the birth of the Messiah when that happened, the second coming will be quite public. So when he comes, everybody will know it in a way that we'll see also momentarily. But he points out if you're hiding in different parts, and there'll be a special place where the Jewish people will be in refuge. If you're hiding, make sure that you don't go out and believe any rumor that the Messiah has come, has returned, because the Messiah's second coming will be quite different and the whole world will see it. And so in verse 27, for as the lightning comes forth from the east and is seen even unto west, so shall be the coming of the Son of Man. And so the second coming will be very, very visible. And so there's no need to respond to a rumor and come out of hiding and put yourself into danger. Stay hidden, because when the Messiah comes, it'll be very, very public. Then verse 28 says, wheresoever the carcass is, there will the eagles, better the vultures, gather together. Now, take your Bibles for a moment and turn to the book of Luke chapter 17. It provides the question in a bit further manner. Luke chapter 17. Now, beginning in verse 22, going down through verse 37, there are also some prophecies involving the return of the Messiah. After giving certain prophecies, look at verse 37. And they answering him, said unto him, where, Lord? Meaning, when this happens, where will you come to? Where will you be? And his answer doesn't give a full answer, because it presupposes some basic knowledge of the Hebrew Bible. And so he said unto them, where the body is, thither will the eagles, the vultures, also be gathered together. So the clue to the disciples as to where the second coming will initially occur, he points out that where you see the body, that's where the vultures naturally gather. The body is the body of Israel, and the vultures represent the Gentile armies. So where the body of Israel happens to be hidden, and that's where the vultures of the Gentiles' army gather to try to wipe out the remaining Jewish population, that is where the second coming will occur. Now, going back to your notes, exactly where this be is spelled out in three key passages: Micah chapter 2, verse 12 and 13, Micah 2, 12 and 13, Isaiah chapter 34, verses 1 through 7, Isaiah 34, verses 1 through 7, Isaiah 63, verses 1 through 6. Isaiah 63, verses 1 through 6. It refers to a place known in Hebrew as Bozra, in English as Bozra. Today it's better known by its Greek name as Petra. And while Jews will also be exiled in Egypt and in Assyria, today it's northern Iraq, the majority of the Jewish population that has fled Jerusalem and the majority leadership will be in this city of Bozra or Petra. It's in the section that used to be in the land of Edom. Today it is southern Jordan. And that is where the Jewish people will be fleeing to. And as these passages I referenced to, we don't have time to look them up. But these passages will emphasize that the remnant will be in the city of Bozra, and that's where the second coming will occur. And these are key passages for understanding the place of the actual second coming. The first place will not be the Mount of Olives. If you look at the text in Zechariah chapter 14, verses 1 through 4, that mentions that when he's finished fighting with all the armies, when Armageddon is finished with, then he will stand on the Mount of Olives. But that follows his fighting all the Gentile armies. And furthermore, early in Zechariah chapter 12, he mentions that the Lord will save the tents of Judah first before he rescues the inhabitants of Jerusalem. And the fact that Judah is living in tents shows they're not living in permanent homes, they're living elsewhere. And where they'll be living elsewhere will be the city of Bozrah or Petra. That's where they'll be. And Zechariah points out the Messiah will come to rescue the Jews there first, and then begin to move towards Jerusalem to rescue the Jewish inhabitants of the city of Jerusalem. And that is the last two or three stages of the campaign of Armageddon. But that is the initial place of the second coming. So let's go on to the next section, section 8 of your outline, which deals with the second coming. The first question was, what is the sign of your coming, of your destruction of Jerusalem? Another sign is, what shall be the sign of your coming? Now they're asking it from the concept of that day, you're coming to establish the Messianic kingdom. But in the context of the actual ways things will be, what is the sign of the second coming? And notice several things here. In Matthew's account, verse 29, but immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun shall be darkened, and the moon shall not give her light, and the stars shall fall from heaven. And the prophecies of the last days talk about blackouts. Altogether, there'll be five specific blackouts when there is no light coming to the earth from the sun or the moon or the stars. Now the first blackout in Joel chapter 2 verse 31, Joel 2:31, will happen sometime before the tribulation starts. The second one will be in the first quarter of the tribulation in Revelation chapter 6. The third one will be in the second quarter of the tribulation in Revelation chapter 9 specifically. The fourth one will be in the second half of the tribulation in Revelation chapter 16, but this is the fifth one here, immediately after the tribulation of those days. And the whole world is enveloped in darkness and blackness. And secondly, there'll be tremendous perplexity on earth. And switching over to Luke's account, in the middle of verse 25, and upon the earth distress of nations in perplexity for the roaring of the sea and billows, men fainting for fear and expectation for the things which are coming upon the world. And so these are two key events, a total blackout, total perplexity upon the earth. And then the third, they'll finally see the sign of the second coming. And look at Matthew's account, verse 30. Then shall appear the sign of the Son of Man in heaven. Then shall all the tribes of the earth mourn, and they shall see the Son of Man coming in the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. The sign itself will be the Shekinah light that everybody in the world can see, that will disperse the darkness that just enveloped the world. And the fifth finally event in this section is going to be the actual second coming of the Messiah. And that, so that by this point, he's answered all of the questions they raised. He'll continue to give us more information about the last days. Now move on to the next segment, section 9, the regathering of Israel. And looking at Matthew's account, verse 31, he shall send forth his angels with a great sound of a trumpet, and they shall gather together his elect from the four winds, from one end of heaven to the other. This is the verse that people often use who hold to post-tribulationism. They notice that they base it upon the sound of a great trumpet, and then they connect that with the trumpet that will signal the rapture of the body of the Messiah. But you have to leave this in its context. Because early on in this context, I begin back in Matthew 24, verse 15, that they will see the abomination of desolation. That's the event that happens in Jerusalem. Then that those in Judea are to flee from Jerusalem. And everything else, it's a very Jewish context. It's a very Israeli context. And the Wadis and so on. And so that is, so whatever verse 31 is dealing with, he's not dealing with the rapture of the church. He's dealing somehow connecting with Israel. And what he says here is simply a paraphrase of a prophecy. Let's look at it in Isaiah chapter 27. Isaiah chapter 27. And look at verse 12. Here it is. He's describing the final regathering of Israel. It shall come to pass in that day that Jehovah will beat off his fruit from the flood of the river unto the brook of Egypt. You shall be gathered one by one, O ye children of Israel. So in verse 12, notice he provides the northern border, the river, a reference to the Euphrates, and the southern border, the brook of Egypt. And that God will gather his people, the Jewish people, one by one until they're all back in the land of Israel. But now look at verse 13. It shall come to pass in that day that a great trumpet shall be blown, and they shall come, they're ready to perish in the land of Assyria, and they that are outcast in the land of Egypt, and they shall worship Jehovah in the holy mountain at Jerusalem. So notice the sound of a great trumpet will signal Israel's final regathering. And again, we must distinguish between two worldwide regatherings of the Jewish people. The first one is the regathering in unbelief in preparation for judgment, the judgment of the tribulation. And the passages for the first regathering, if you want to just mark them down, include Ezekiel chapter 20, verses 33-38, Ezekiel 20, 33-38, Ezekiel chapter 22, verses 17-22, Zephaniah chapter 2, verses 1 and 2, Zephaniah chapter 2, verses 1 and 2. And thus the regathering was seen fulfilled with the present Jewish state. But there's going to be a second worldwide regathering in faith in preparation for blessings, specifically the blessings of the Messianic kingdom, and that's what he's referring to here. And so what he says in Matthew chapter 24, verse 31, is simply paraphrases Isaiah 27, verse 13. And so the regathering of his elect, the Jewish people, the regathering is going to be with the sound of a great trumpet. Now look what Mark says, because he words it a bit differently. And in Mark's account, verse 27, then shall he gather, send forth the angels, who shall gather together his elect from the four winds, from the uttermost part of the earth to the uttermost part of heaven. It knows the regathering is from two localities, the uttermost parts of the earth and the uttermost parts of heaven. He's paraphrasing a slightly different passage. Look at the book of Deuteronomy chapter 30, the fifth book of Moses, the book of Deuteronomy chapter 30. In chapter 29, he talks about the worldwide dispersion. In chapter 30, he talks about Israel's national salvation in verses 1 and 2. And now look at verse 3. That then Jehovah your God will turn your captivity and have compassion upon you, and will return and gather you from all the peoples whither Jehovah your God has scattered you. If any of the outcasts be in the uttermost parts of heaven, from thence will Jehovah your God gather you, from thence he will fetch you. And what he says here with the regathering from different parts of the earth and the different, even out of heaven, is what Mark is saying in his account of the Olivet Discourse, because it will be from two localities, the Jews out of heaven and the Jews out of different parts of the earth will all come together to enjoy the Messianic kingdom. The point he's making is the final restoration will happen only following the second coming, not before it. And that's what he makes quite clear. But he's now dealing with the rapture event in this context, or he will be dealing with it in a different context. We won't get that till tomorrow morning. Let's go ahead and deal with one more segment. Well, actually, two segments. Notice Luke's exhortation in Luke chapter 21 and verse 28. But when these things begin to come to pass, look up and lift up your heads, because your redemption draws near. The phrase "these things" goes back to his prophecy back in verses 20 through 24, where he mentioned that there's going to be a destruction of the city that was fulfilled in AD 70. Once that prophecy was fulfilled, that once the prophecy about the temple being destroyed was fulfilled, that rendered the rapture imminent, meaning at that point it could happen at any moment of time. And then he picks up that theme with the next event. I'm going to close with this one, the parable of the fig tree. That should be on your next page. He introduces the section in verse 32 of Matthew. Now from the fig tree learn her parable. And what has happened late 70s and moving into 1980s, what has begun taking place is many books started to come out trying to prove the rapture has to happen in 1981. Because they assume the fig tree represents Israel becoming a state back in 1948. And a generation is always 40 years. And so from 1948 to 1988 is that generation. So 1988 will be the second coming. And then you subtract 7 years for the tribulation. The rapture will come in 1981. Well, 1981 came and went. So they began to adjust it and say, we should see it as happening exactly 40 years later, and that's in the year 1988. And a good number of books came out to prove the rapture will come in 1988. The most famous one was called 88 Reasons Why the Rapture Will Come in 1988. And I started getting letters from different parts of the world, not just the USA, but also from Australia, from New Zealand, from England, and elsewhere. What do I think about what he wrote? So I didn't want to take time to read it, but I don't like to critique a book until I read it, so I went ahead and bought it. The vast majority of his reasons had nothing to do with Israel, had to do with the American Congress, what number it was, and so on, as if that is supposed to be significant prophetically. And I finally couldn't answer all those letters because there were just too many of them coming, so I wrote a manuscript entitled 88 Reasons Why the Book is Mistaken. And so on. And if that wasn't enough, 88 came and went. No rapture. So he then wrote a second book, 89 Reasons Why the Rapture Will Come in 1989. He said he made a 1-year mistake. 1989 came and went. That book did not become quite as popular. And I thank the Lord he did not write a subsequent book called 90 Reasons Why the Rapture Will Come in 1990. It was all based upon, initially from this passage here, he assumed that the fig tree has to be Israel becoming a state. And since the second coming will happen within the same generation that sees Israel becoming a state, therefore, the rapture has to come in 1988. A lot of people held to that basic view, but they made two basic mistakes. First of all, the fig tree is not necessarily a symbol of Israel. when things are used in Scripture, they're used in three different ways. It could be literal as literal. It could be literal as an illustration, or it could be simply symbolic. And the fig tree here is used literal as an illustration. And people only look at the Matthew passage. Now, from the fig tree, learn her parable. But look at Luke's account in verse 29. And he spoke unto them a parable, behold the fig tree, and what else? And all the other trees. So if the fig tree is Israel, what do these other trees supposed to mean? If they mean the rise of other nations, then they came at different times. So when you begin your 40-year countdown. But using the fig tree here literally as an illustration, that's where this one fits. The second error is to assume that the term generation has always has to mean 40 years. Sometimes it does mean 40 years, but sometimes it means less than that. Sometimes it could mean 70 or 80 years. In one place, like in Genesis chapter 15, it is 400 years. Because God tells Abram the reason he cannot give him the land right away is because the iniquity of the Amorite is not yet full. But eventually will be full, and he says in 400 years it will be full. And then in the fourth generation, he'll come to give you the land. So you have 4 centuries and 4 generations. How long is a generation in that scheme? Each one's 100 years old. But quite often the word generation doesn't give a time zone, just means the same way we use the term generation today. Meaning the contemporaries. I may talk about my father's generation and my generation. I'm not implying there's 40 years between us. There's only 22 years between us. But here we're dealing with his generation in contrast to my generation, and so on. So we stay in the context. And so what he's saying is that when you see the fig tree and these other trees blossoming and budding, what does that mean? It means that summer is coming. It's a sign of summer coming. And then he makes the application, looking at Matthew verse 33. Even so also when you see all these things, know that he is near even at the doors. Now when you see these things in this context, what's he talking about? He's not talking about Israel becoming a state in 1948. That was nowhere in the context. But the context begins in verse 15, when you see the abomination of desolation. That's when the time element begins. And the same Jewish generation that sees the abomination of desolation will still be here when the Messiah comes 3.5 years later. Now the rapture will never be a datable event. Anytime you see a new book giving you the date of the rapture, don't buy it. It's going to go out of print, and you made the guy rich. It can happen any moment of time between even today up until the signing of the 7-year covenant. That's the time zone for the rapture to begin. But the second coming will be a datable event once the tribulation hits. It will happen exactly 7 years following the signing of the covenant. Will happen exactly 3.5 years or 42 months or 1,260 days following the abomination of desolation. So the second coming will be a very datable event. And so the point then is that the same Jewish generation that sees the abomination of desolation, that sees the inauguration of a worldwide attempt to annihilate the Jewish people, the Jews will still be here when the second coming occurs. It means that the attempt to annihilate the Jews once and for all will fail. It will not succeed. And the purpose is to serve as the word of comfort to the Jews living at this point of time, especially for the Messianic Jews living at this point of time, that they know that the days are limited for the Antichrist to rule and to persecute. And so Israel will indeed survive. Now, what we can go to the next page. Starting tomorrow, in the two sessions we'll have in the morning, we'll have more to say about the rapture. And so we'll deal with the rest of the Olivet Discourse in the time in the morning services. Okay, we've got about 11 minutes for questions. We'll open the floor for the questions. Who's got the first question? Raise your hand. Okay. Yes, you were here yesterday when we talked about the timing element that Luke gives and so on. But he mentions what's going to happen. He says certain things will happen before these things will happen. And so essentially what Luke says is going to happen during the period of the lives of the apostles. And by the time that period ends, the Romans will destroy the city and the temple. But now we're dealing here with a different time element, the tribulation, the dispersion within the Middle East and things of that nature. So we've got those two different elements. And again, when you in the case of Luke, he specified what I'm talking about next will happen before you see the sign of the last days, kingdom against kingdom, nation against nation. But in Matthew's account, he uses the word then, after the kingdom against kingdom thing, then these things will happen. So Luke describes things happening before certain events, and Matthew describes they'll happen after those events. And those are the timing elements. That's why we have to have all three Gospels parallel to see what's going on. Question? Yes.
You mentioned the mark will happen mid-trib.
The issue of the mark will only be inaugurated at the midpoint of tribulation. That's not in Olivet Discourse. That's in Revelation 13. As the Antichrist at the midpoint takes over the world, takes over the Jewish temple, commits the abomination of desolation, which is a mid-trib event. In Daniel 9:27, for example, that's when these things are going to occur. And that's when he inaugurates the taking of the mark of the beast. I know some teach that if you take the inoculation against the coronavirus, that's taking the mark of the beast. That's just typical nonsense of not listening to the text or what it really says. And the Greek word is epi, which means upon, be a visible sign upon the skin. It won't be whatever you insert with the needle. Question? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You read books about, New York being the modern Babylon and things like this.
Yeah, that's what I call newspaper exegesis. When I'm in England, they think London is the Babylon. But what's the text say? It says Babylon. It mentions the Euphrates River. New York is not on the Euphrates. London is not on the Euphrates. Babylon is on the Euphrates and so on. And they say, well, the Bible says you'll never be rebuilt, but it says that after it suffers a specific type of destruction in Isaiah 13 and 14 and in Jeremiah 50:51. So only after it suffers. Now, the Babylon never suffered the kind of destruction prophesied. If you look at the book of Daniel, the Babylonians captured the city intact. The only casualty was Belshazzar, who was executed. They took the city intact and continued to survive for a long time, but eventually became a ghost town. But the rest of Daniel's life under Medo-Persia was in Babylon. He was one of the three presidents, co-presidents of Babylonia. So Jeremiah talks about Babylon and Isaiah, it means Babylon has to suffer that kind of a destruction. There are people who now believe. There are people who now believe we are now that the tribulation has already been fulfilled in the Holocaust, and that now it's incumbent upon all Jews to return to Israel. and emissaries of that view came to the congregation we planted in St. Petersburg, Russia, telling the Jews there, it's good to believe in Jesus, but that's not the, but if you really want to be saved, you have to move to Israel right away. And emissaries of that view came to the congregation I was a member of. It was a Messianic congregation in California before I moved back to San Antonio. And he was saying to the Messianic Jewish members that they must immediately pack up and move to Israel. And the elders asked him for some biblical authentication. And he took him to Jeremiah 50 and 51, where he calls upon the Jews to leave Babylon. And they said, well, it says Babylon. And so, and the guy says, well, when Jeremiah said Babylon, that was just a symbol of the USA. And they pointed out, well, it mentions the Euphrates River. Well, that was Jeremiah's symbol what's the big river here?
Mississippi
River. And I'm sure that would surprise Jeremiah if he had heard that. So you've got people practicing all these what I call newspaper exegesis, applying symbols which were not intended to be used for symbols or intended to be used for symbols, but you rely on the scriptures to give you that symbol. You don't pick up a newspaper and say, this must be it. Okay, we've got 5 more minutes. Question?
Okay. Israel is now flourishing.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
But when it speaks here on, when you talk about the desolation and abomination, and it said, except for those days have been shortened, no flesh would have been saved. Okay.
And the
during that tribulation,
if you hadn't cut the period of persecutions cut suddenly short, no Jews would have survived. Because now you're dealing with a worldwide persecution of the Jews, a Nazi-like persecution that will begin at the midpoint of the tribulation and will continue for 3.5 years. And so that's not what Israel's facing yet. They won't face it. Israel is safe until the midpoint of the tribulation. No, this is the Jewish context. The abomination of desolation is Jerusalem. Let them that are in Judea flee. That's a Jewish context. It's an Israeli context. The Wadis are Israeli context. The Sabbath is an Israeli context. In a Jewish neighborhood in the United States, they may not travel on the Sabbath day, but still have buses and trains running. But that's not true in Israel. Those things are shut down for the Sabbath from sundown Friday till sundown Saturday. And those are things as a whole, Jewish context, and more specifically, it's an Israeli context. So that's what he's talking about. He's not talking about the non-Jews there. Yeah?
If I'm an Israeli Jew, pardon my ignorance, but if I'm an Israeli Jew who doesn't accept Jesus as Messiah, where do I fall into the...
But going back to the principle that was set up with the prophets like Isaiah chapter 8 and so on, like distinguishing between the remnant and the non-remnant. And the remnant are those who believe what God had revealed to Moses and the prophets. The non-remnant are those who reject it. But Isaiah 8, he prophesies that when the Emmanuel prophecy is fulfilled, the remnant would be made up of those who accept him as the Messiah, and the non-remnant is those who reject him as the Messiah. So those of us who are Jews and accept them, and I'm one of them, that would the Bible refer to me as members of the remnant. But the non-remnant are those who do not believe in his messiahship, and so on. But as long as you're living, you're welcome to come into the faith.
So do you think that there will be another Holocaust for the Jewish people?
I thought I mentioned that already in detail.
Yes.
Well, just look at Zechariah 13, verse 8 and 9. In that future Holocaust, 2/3 of the Jewish population will die. 2/3. The 1/3 who will survive will come to faith in the Messiah.
Right.
Read it.
That's the final 3.5 years.
And that the final 3.5 years, that the Jews are going to be targeted just as under Nazi Germany. All Jews that the Nazis conquered in Europe, not just Germany, but Poland, Russia, and elsewhere, Jews were targeted. And again, members of my family perished. Last one.
So then the one-third of the Jews that survived will be the all Israel of Rome.
That's the all Israel that will be saved.
So all Israel that exists.
Yeah, but that's the all Israel still living. Okay, my time is up, so we shall stop here, and we'll have more sessions tomorrow morning.
Thank you.
You're welcome.